Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. Tonight, we're talking about affordable housing in San Francisco. For decades, San Francisco has operated under a housing deficit, not enough housing to match the size of its population. With an already high population density and a dearth of space for new buildouts, it's no wonder that the National Low Income Housing Coalition recently dubbed San Francisco the costliest city for renters in the United States. Add to that Governor Jerry Brown's defunding of redevelopment agencies late last year, and an already challenging problem seems likely to get worse. But according to affordable housing advocates, there's one more crucial point. A series of redevelopment projects over several decades has led to the displacement of many low-income residents to other counties in the Bay Area. As Mayor Ed Lee here in San Francisco meets with stakeholders to create a housing trust fund, we hear tonight from affordable housing advocates on their take on how to solve San Francisco's housing crisis. I welcome to the program Peter Cohen. He's co-director at the Council of Community Housing Organizations, or CHOCHO, or CHUCHU, and it's a collective of 20 nonprofit organizations and faith-based groups that are part of a housing development network aimed at the creation of permanently affordable low-income housing in San Francisco. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you very much.
And I also welcome Oscar Grande. He is a community organizer at PODER, which is People Organized to Demand Environment Economic Rights. PODER is an environmental justice organization based in the Mission District here in San Francisco. It began advocating for affordable housing issues since the dot-com boom affected housing prices in the Mission District in the late 90s. Welcome, Oscar.
Hey, good evening.
And we welcome you, our listeners, as always, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in a little less than 20 minutes, and you can call 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134 with your questions and comments. You can email us now at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com. Or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. So, Peter Cohen of the Council of Community Housing Organizations, or CHOCHU.
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 Yeah.
Okay. Why don't you expand a little bit upon what I was talking about in the introduction about the affordable housing crisis here in San Francisco? How did we get here, and what is perhaps unique to this area that has created this problem?
Well, the need for affordable housing has always been acute in San Francisco, and you know, there's not a year that goes by when we don't see a deficiency of our production, and so we're always trying to advocate for more funding, for more just political attention to the need to keep up with the demands of affordable housing. But we're also in a unique situation this year. In, as you mentioned, that the redevelopment agencies across the state have been dissolved. And for better or worse, that had become one of the primary funding sources for local affordable housing development in San Francisco and elsewhere. And so we're rapidly trying to restore that and rebalance after, you know, 10, 15 years of coming to rely on a system through redevelopment.
And what would you say are some of the key challenges to affordable housing besides financing or funding for it that you fight against every day in your work?
Well, San Francisco, aside from just the cost and challenge of creating affordable housing, has this unique situation. It's a very land-constrained city. You know, it's a 7x7 city, the tip of a peninsula. And so our primary asset and yet the thing that we have the least of is space. So if you look at jurisdictions elsewhere in the region, they have a lot more space to work with. That doesn't mean they have the resources to build the housing. Here, we're always in a struggle to find sufficient number of sites that are actually in access to infrastructure and services. So for us, it's the game of land access and sites for doing our affordable housing work.
Is it just a matter of just not having enough space, or are there other factors at play here?
Well, I mean, there's competition for those sites, too. I mean, San Francisco is also a international city. It has a tremendous draw. So to the extent that we're in the affordable housing side trying to keep up with our demands, we're also in this incredibly kind of competitive environment, if you will, of, you know, other development meeting demands of populations that are moving to San Francisco constantly.
I was reading an article in the New York Times that was published actually last Thursday that talks a little bit about how San Francisco for decades has kind of been behind. This is for housing deficit that I mentioned in the introduction. This mismatch between the amount of people who live here, the amount of people who work here, and the amount of housing for those people. Do you have any sense of the historical arcs of why there was always this mismatch? Is it just these issues we were talking about, or is there something else here, another set of factors at play that explain why historically San Francisco has always been sort of a difficult place to find a place to live?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has, again, much to do with the fact that we have a limited supply of land, and there is just a kind of, you know, there's a maximum capacity of how much housing could be produced, whether it's affordable housing or market rate housing. Just pushing, you know, product, if you will, through the pipeline each year takes a lot of bureaucracy and money and production capacity. And that has never been able to really keep up with demand at any at any level. And so we find ourselves in San Francisco always chasing the demand curve. And again, we're in a kind of a unique environment. In many respects, the natural balance of supply and demand for setting prices and for deciding what products are delivered doesn't work in San Francisco. We have, some might argue and I might believe, an insatiable demand for new populations coming in. And so that creates this kind of crisis for us on the housing side, as well as the more intensified competition between market rate housing and affordable housing for that space.
And I don't necessarily want to jump to possible solutions yet, but one thought that occurs to me immediately is, well, if we can't build out, how about building up? And so what's the debate? And you're nodding your head there, recognizing that suggestion. What has the debate been like around that potential solution, building upwards instead of, you know, keep butting our heads against the fact that we have a limitation on how out we
right.
can build?
Sure. I mean, in more recent years, I would say the debate has become more nuanced. If you go back in, you know, 20 or more years, there were great fights in San Francisco over what they call the Manhattanization of the city. You know, it was always this sort of a sense that San Francisco was not a big high-rise city, whether it be residential or commercial. And that framed a lot of the land use policies and politics of the 70s and the 80s and even to the early 90s. In many respects, I think we're kind of over the most dramatic kind of black and white fight over the height of the city. And now it becomes the nuances of where is appropriate. You know, if we talk with Oscar about what's appropriate in a neighborhood like the Mission District, what's appropriate in downtown or Rincon Hill, they're very different answers. But you're right. I mean, that is the vertical densification of the city. And it doesn't always work for everybody. I mean, I think as we talk a little further about what is the kind of housing that serves people well in an 8-story building versus a 120-story building. But certainly up has been part of the solution.
So, Oscar Grande, I wanted to turn to you now, community organizer with Poder, people organized to demand environment and economic rights, to maybe look at the Mission as a case study to frame our conversation. Why don't you give us a picture of how the Mission has changed over the last several decades and how this issue of affordable housing is particularly acute in that neighborhood?
I think, you know, me, born and raised in this city, I'm an Excelsior boy here and who really has found a cultural and political home in the Mission District when my family first immigrated to this country from El Salvador. And I think what we've seen over the decades and more recently is that, you know, Mission District has historically been a place where an immigrant can get their start, a place where you can just, you know, come with your bags packed and not much money, resources, but you had a home in the Mission District. And I think from the turn of the century, we've seen that, you know, be it Irish immigrants, Spanish, Mexican, Central American, to Asian immigrants. And what has happened over the past decade, we've really seen those that this was an entry point for a lot of people wanting to establish themselves in San Francisco, work in the local industries that were thriving at the time. You know, a lot of it, warehouse work and a lot of,
you know, from like garment making to, you know, making things, manufacturing. And we've seen a lot of that, you know, shipped out. A lot of that has been lost, you know, much of it to globalization, but much of it too to surrounding surrounding counties and suburbs. But I think because of the amount of speculation, the amount of venture capitalism that has flowed through the city and has kind of zeroed in on the Mission District, that you see a lot of these battles around housing and around development without displacement. And that's really the core of why an organization, Poder, exists, and you know, dozens of organizations and hundreds of activists that are really trying to figure this out together. How do we have development without displacement? Because the other convention is, do you just keep it ghetto? Do you just keep it do you just keep it hood? Do you keep it ugly? Do you keep it you know, quality of life down and substandard? And I think our communities have been around for a long time and have really built up a neighborhood when there was no resources, when there wasn't the amount of attention from policymakers, and people by their own blood, sweat, and tears have really created and threaded a fabric of community resiliency that we're slowly seeing being deteriorated. And I think as the neighborhood becomes more and more popular, as you see what we're seeing now is a lot more streetscape improvements, a lot more attention to infrastructure being played, a lot more attention on economic development, small business development. But what those that have been impacted the worst and have been impacted first are last in line to get those resources and are actually being displaced. So a lot of the low-income and moderate-income families and individuals that really created the Mission what it is today.
So give us a sense of how that displacement occurs. How do improvements to the streetscape and infrastructure or the growths of small businesses, you know, one need only take a stroll down Valencia Street these days to see how much has happened in the course of the recent economic downturn. It's sort of a bit sort of paradoxical. How do those improvements and those enhancements, how do they lead to displacement? If you can kind of connect the dots. Right.
Well, if we're not addressing land tenure or community governance, a lot of these improvements lead to displacement because, you know, the market dictates if this is a popular neighborhood, you're going to have landlords trying figuring out ways, schemes on how to, you know, how to get rid of their tenants. You have commercial landlords, you know, commercial spaces don't have rent control. And so it's a lot harder, especially if you're an immigrant owned mom and pop, you know, who's invested all their life savings in this one storefront. I mean, your landlord can just from one month, as soon as that lease is up, you know, you'll see $3,000 rent going for $7,000, which we're seeing on Mission Street. I'm working right now with a family, you know, it's a Arabic-owned business who subleases to Bolivian immigrant businesses, and they just seen their lease just went up. They're paying $3,000 for the past 10 years. Now it's shot up to $7,000. And business owners telling me, you're seeing the whole block go that way. So we're saying as soon as these guys' lease goes up in a couple years, it's going to shoot up. And so with you know, kind of the newfound popularity and without any sort of regulations or any sort of we're going to continue seeing this happening over and over again. Valencia Street's another perfect example where you see a lot of this kind of hyper investment going in. You have a lot of high-end destination restaurants opening up, boutiques, and that corridor from you know, I would say even 6-7 years ago. It's a totally different corridor. And 16th and Valencia, which is every corner is actually affordable housing, family affordable housing. So you have a large number of families. You have Valencia Gardens down the street. You have a lot of senior buildings. You know, a lot of people that have stable housing because of rent control, because of affordable housing, but yet don't have any of the business services or any of the amenities that, you know, lower income, moderate income people can afford. So you can't even get your nails done anywhere. You can't wash your clothes, but you can get a $100 haircut. You can get a $40, you know, meal and a $20 cocktail, no problem.
So you mentioned how the lack of rent control on commercial spaces really can cause this overnight changeover of affordability for a lot of small business owners. And you also just mentioned how the changes in the services and of a community really can be a mismatch for those who are original or more recent tenants in an area. How does this affect people who are housed, though? Are you seeing people who are getting evicted, or are you seeing other ways in which people are being forced out of their stable living situations? And can you comment a little bit on that?
I think what we see, it's a whole, you know, I'm still trying to wrap my head around it, but, you know, the stories we're hearing on the ground is that, you know, you have a community where we're talking decades-long infrastructure of a nonprofit structure, of a, you know, private housing structure, affordable housing structure that have been weaved, and because of the displacement, because of families being pushed out, that you see families who can no longer afford to live, you know, in San Francisco in the Mission, and are moving, you know, are finding better deals in Richmond or Pinole, El Sobrante or Antioch, and yet are commuting back to their home, where their kinship support network is, where their kids go to school, have gone to school for years, where their churches are at, where their favorite, you know, pupuseria is at. And I think that really, that is unhealthy for a community where you have to commute to find your place, to find your home, a place that you help develop and invested in for so many years. And so we're seeing a lot of that happening, that mismatch happening.
Yeah, Peter, do you want to add something to that about displacement from those who are housed in neighborhoods that transition in these ways?
Yeah. And it made me think of some data that we put together and mapped several years ago during the real height of the last real estate surge with live work and .com, you know, .com round one. We're kind of getting into .com round two. So this is sort of the mid to late 90s through the early 2000s. And we just looked at the Mission District because we wanted to get kind of a snapshot of what transition meant for families at ground level. You know, we have rent control, rent stabilization in San Francisco, so we actually got data and we plotted it out kind of in three-year segments. And what was phenomenal, and your listeners can't see these maps, but I'm looking at them here, you know, over that period of 1990 to 2005, you see the number of evictions, and these are legal evictions that are actually recorded by the city. They're not necessarily, I mean, they may be contested, but they are perfectly legal, which is something striking in itself, astronomically grew over that period. And there were several different types of evictions. They give them different classifications. There's owner move-ins. There's evictions that are created by demolishing and rebuilding a site.
And that basically erases the rent control on the property.
Yeah, if there's no building, there's no rent control. So you demolish.
And the new property doesn't qualify for rent control.
That's correct, yes. Uh-huh. Only buildings constructed prior to 1978 qualify for rent control. So between demolitions, between owner move-ins, which allows an absentee owner to move back into one of their units or have a family member move in, and then finally Ellis Act evictions, which is a state law that really got taken advantage of starting in the early 2000s that effectively allow a landlord to go out of business and legally, again, evict tenants and then resell that building for ownership purposes, where we got a lot of TICs, tenancies in commons, coming from. So between those different types of evictions, again, all legal, and just the number of them,
it was really striking what was happening in the Mission during that period. And it's hard to draw a cause and effect. You know, it's like this thing caused that eviction. But when you map that kind of pattern on top of all that was happening at the time in that neighborhood with the businesses Oscar was talking about and the change in demographics, it's hard not to see that there's this ripple effect, this, you know, what we call gentrification that was happening in the Mission. And this is really a surge as opposed to something that happens and stops. It's kind of going on a continuous basis. But this kind of surge of activity was very clear to us. And the magic question is, well, what do you do about it, you know? And I think, if as I was thinking earlier, if anybody could figure that out, they should write a book and they should go on the lecture circuit. Because I think a lot of folks are really trying to figure out, as Oscar said, how to do development without displacement, how to invest capital into a community which has a lot of vulnerability to it and not disrupt, not do harm. You know, I don't want to put this into kind of a large theoretical sense, but real estate development is capitalism. I mean, this is real estate capitalism. It's private money for the most part, chasing opportunities to create whatever kind of profit off of land. And there are all sorts of intended or unintended consequences around disruptions to social and physical fabric. And I think a lot of us have been exploring ways to respond to that without shrink-wrapping a neighborhood and saying nothing should happen.
Because then you're talking, as you said, Oscar, is then would you be keeping certain enhancements and certain improvements away from a neighborhood in an attempt to keep it from being gentrified and people being displaced? But then, of course, that affects the quality of life of the people who live there. In case you're just joining us, this is City Visions on 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're talking about affordable housing in San Francisco. We have two guests here, both affordable housing advocates, and we're taking a look from that lens tonight. Peter Cohen, he is co-director of the Council of Community Housing Organizations, or CHU-CHU, and maybe later you'll explain why. And Oscar Grande is a community organizer at PODER, People Organized to Demand Environment Economic Rights. We welcome you, our listeners, to call in with your questions and comments at 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. Are you a renter in San Francisco? Are you in an up-and-coming neighborhood and worried about being displaced? Are you someone who's considering buying in one of these up-and-coming neighborhoods and trying to decide how to do that and what that might mean, what the neighborhood that you're moving into and perhaps potentially inadvertently displacing someone? 415-841-4134. Are you a housing developer and want to approach this conversation from that point of view? 415-841-4134, or you can email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or comment on our Facebook page. So I wanted to get back to something that you said in your comments, Oscar, and either of you can comment on this, Peter or Oscar, is this issue of being in a speculative environment. Let's talk about that. How much is speculation part of this issue here in San Francisco?
Well, I think what we've learned over the past decade, you know, during the first wave of dot-com and high-tech coming into the city, that the speculation drives policymakers to give tax breaks to businesses. The speculation, I think it really clouds the judgment of policymakers, where to attract that money, to attract that, you know, that prominence that San Francisco gets for being you know, the hub of high tech, that, you know, it drives policymakers and decision makers to you know, tax breaks business. You know, we have like Twitter. Allows decision makers to, you know, give breaks to housing developers. I think it creates an environment where it makes it a lot harder. Is the point that Peter's saying, competition, that, you know, affordable housing developers and community advocates don't have the political juice nor the capital that private developers have, and it's hard to to collaborate in that kind of atmosphere. It's hard to really make sound policy decisions that really look out for all of San Francisco's peoples. It makes it real difficult.
Hmm. Do you want to add to that, Peter, about this speculation and how much of that drives this concern of yours?
Yeah, I'll just come back to the point I made earlier, which is we're in this tiny little city, you know, this 7x7 city with a population of 800,000 and, you know, a sort of beacon, if you will, you know, across the globe. People want to come here. They want to come here as a place of refuge, or they want to come here as a place of entertainment. And so the speculation in land, right, for real estate is very intense. There's hardly a parcel of land in San Francisco that doesn't have a set of eyes on it. And it's one thing to point out, by the way, for listeners out there, is that for the most part, affordable housing pays the same land price anybody else does. So, you know, we're chasing very expensive real estate. It's part of what makes affordable housing in San Francisco expensive. It's part of what makes any housing in San Francisco expensive. It's not as though because it's affordable housing or it's subsidized by public money that somehow there's a deal on the dirt. So we're paying incredible rates for this. And as speculation continues to drive a lot of the dynamics, as Oscar said, that drives up land prices, which makes affordable housing, again, more expensive.
And what gets the housing to then become affordable if you're still paying the same market rate for the land?
Well, there's different costs. The first cost is the land acquisition. It's just public money, for the most part, paying for, you know, privately held land, for the most part. Sometimes there's good deals you can add if it's publicly owned land, if there's some kind of a swap. But you're paying out for the land acquisition. And then there's public money that's put in for the pre-development costs, the soft costs and whatnot. And then finally, there's the major capital that's put in for construction. Some of that city money, some of it's tax credit. They're very complicated financing packages that put all this together. So much of it is public money or leveraged money that comes from public money. That's what creates it. And then the affordability is basically what's charged for the rent. There is a very fixed formula for how much rent a family can pay based on their household income, and it's set in a very prescriptive formula. And then that subsidy, that income return, is what is subsidized in the kind of operating cost for the building. That has to be made up somehow.
And who pays those subsidies?
Well, I'm not a financing guy, but it depends on how the deal is structured. But if there is, you know, very, very low rate of income from the building, that operating subsidy has to be backfilled with public money. There are ways that they can figure out how to make sure that the income that's received actually pays for those operating costs without having an additional subsidy. But the point here is that there is no profit that comes out of the rents or the prices that are paid for those units. They're actually held to specific price points.
And what's the developer's role in creating affordable housing?
The affordable housing developer?
Yeah.
Well, you know, they act just like any other developer in many respects. I mean, it's interesting, the affordable housing development industry, and there is kind of an industry and a movement. You know, there are the housers, and we actually have organizations that build housing, and they're very professional and you know, kind of match the market rate housing development industry in terms of their capability. So they're looking for sites. They're, you know, putting out options on sites. They're trying to work with the city to get money in advance for site acquisition. Then they're trying to leverage those tax credits and funding sources. It's very competitive. And they're building the units. And typically, they're also owning them and managing them and providing services over the long term. One thing that's very specific about affordable housing development, for the most part, is that the same developers who build it own it over time. And so there's a long-term community development investment that's happening in addition to the bricks and mortar. And that's a really important point about how affordable housing typically comes into a community versus just kind of a build and sell or build and lease and go on to the next project.
Staying with that point of developers, though, my understanding is that there's some sort of mandate that 15% of all new buildings or units need to be affordable. How is that determined, and how are people keeping track of that, and what does that mean? Does that mean any new building that's being built, or is it only building that are being built by nonprofit developers? Where does this 15% number that I heard come from?
Sure. You're gonna unpack all these technical things, which is important because I think it's a complicated topic for people to understand. So when we talk about affordable housing development that a lot of the choo-choo member organizations do, it's typically 100% affordable units. You know, all the units in that building are affordable at different kinds of price points. It's heavily publicly subsidized and leveraged external sources. In addition to that, the city has policies that require market rate developers to have a certain percentage of their units which are priced for moderate income households. They're not the same levels of affordability that our folks typically build for, but they're more moderate middle income San Franciscans.
And what do you mean by moderate or middle income?
Well, these go in kind of percentages. So they use an area median income as kind of a benchmark, right? And so you have 100% of area median income. I'm going to have to go from memory here, but I think it's typically for a family of four, area median income for San Francisco is around $100,000 annual income. And then you go on either side of that. So they'll have inclusionary housing, as they call it. These are the kind of required.
And just to compare for those people who build 100% affordable housing, what kind of incomes are they targeting? Just so we can make a comparison.
I didn't bring my cheat sheet with me. Well, if 100% AMI is somewhere around $100,000 for a family of four, affordable housing is often built for families at 60% AMI or below, because that's where a lot of the federal and state and tax credit money caps. You literally can't build housing that's more expensive than that. You can do kind of hybrid sometimes.
Okay, so for $60,000 or less, and then the market rate developers have to do something for the people who are around $100,000 for a family of four.
Roughly.
Okay, so back to this 15% rule.
Right, so let's just say you have a building of 100 units. In market rate developer, you have a 100-unit project. You're required to have 15% of those be at this 100% AMI or this moderate income level. You can also do that by virtue of writing the city a check, which they call an in-lieu fee. But most of us at the community level and in the advocacy movement would like to see those units actually built because it provides that mixed income housing.
And are they being built?
Fairly well. You know, it rolls with the market because, of course, this is a requirement on market rate developers. So when market rate housing is up, then you get more what we call BMR units, below market rate units, these inclusionary units. When the construction is down, you get fewer. But it's generally worked pretty well. In the 10 years or so since this is called inclusionary housing, since the inclusionary housing ordinance was put together in San Francisco and was led by then Supervisor Mark Leno, who is now state senator, there's been about 900 to 1,000 of these inclusionary units that have been produced, and they are essentially permanently affordable at moderate income level, and it's pretty darn good.
Because what I've been reading is a lot of the developers are currently saying that in this current economic climate, this 15% requirement is too much for them, and that needs to be eased in a way moving forward. I'm curious what you would have to say to a response like that.
You know, generalizing here, but they said the same thing during the boom too. You know, I think this is the responsibility of a developer, you know, in order to keep neighborhoods intact, this is the minimum. You know, if I ran the world, we'd be looking at 50%, you know, inclusionary. There was a time when we were talking 25%, yeah. And I think it's important to Peter talked about there's the development side of affordable housing, and then there's the movement side, which is strong, which is active, which is across neighborhoods, across the city, working with different populations, folks at different incomes. And I think the movement side, all of these policies weren't given up. They were hard-fought battles that the affordable housing movement won. You know, if developers had their way, there would be no inclusionary housing.
So follow-up to that is, do you think there ever is a business case that can be made to developers to get more into the affordable housing, to be aligned with the affordable housing movement, if capitalism is such the driver that we all are saying it is tonight?
I mean, I'll take the nuanced position, but I mean, I I don't think we should assume that the Monterey development community in San Francisco is opposed to affordable housing. In fact, you know, we're trying to align right now. We're in the process of trying to put together a housing trust fund that hopefully will be introduced this week, which will be a significant restoration of our redevelopment money. And we're trying to work with the Monterey developers. So I think there's at some philosophical level, there's typically some level of alignment. You know, we all play in the same sandbox in San Francisco, but they're approaching this as a business matter. I mean, this is Oscar's a community activist. The Chuchu is an advocate around affordable housing and community development. But from a pure business standpoint, you know, they're looking at it with, okay, I agree with you, but how much is it going to cost me? And there's always that tension between, you know, their bottom line and kind of making sure there's sufficient profitability and kind of business risk and all that stuff, and then what they would like to believe we're doing for good public policy. And that's the area of tension that we're always battling around.
This is City Visions on 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and we're discussing affordable housing in San Francisco with our guests, Peter Cohen, the co-director of the Council of Community Housing Organizations, and Oscar Grande, community organizer with Poder. 415-841-4134 or feedback at cityvisionsradio.com. Again, 415-841-4134 with your questions and comments. Feedback at cityvisionsradio.com for emails, or you can post a comment on our Facebook page. Let's go to our first caller, Joanne from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks a lot. I have a comment, and I guess if you know you want to comment on it. And it's on not housing, but rent control on people who have lived in existing housing for a long time who are either low income and or on a fixed income. It's hard enough for people who have, you know, are making, you know, $10, $12 an hour, who have lived in a home for a long time, and then someone buys the home and they have to leave. But to evict seniors, there's rent control, but if someone has a unit, this has happened, I'm from San Francisco, to family friends of ours, women who have lived in a home for 30, 40 years, and they maybe live in a little downstairs in-law or something, and then the person who owns the house says they want to move a family member in. On one occasion, we found out later they hadn't. In any case, but even if they do, that person who's living, you know, on their maybe $750 a month Social Security has to leave. And the worst part is there's literally no place for them to go. I've spent months, like day in, day out, when this arose a couple of times, calling every single agency. There's literally no place to go. With two different family members over the past 6 years, two different women, they finally ended up in Laguna Honda because there was literally no place for them to live. And they went from being, you know, self-sufficient and having their home that they had lived in for 30, 40 years, making their meals, shopping, to just lying in a bed in Laguna Honda, dying, because they pretty much had no life.
Okay, thanks so much, Joanne, for your call. Oscar, did you want to comment?
No, it's just heartbreaking. It saddens me, you know, being born and raised in the city and, you know, coming from a blue-collar, working-class neighborhood that, you know, stories like this are unfortunately common. You know, we, Poder worked on an organizing project on 23rd and Folsom where, you know, we organized with the community to turn a brownfield site, a formerly toxic site. You know, we got the city to remediate it, clean it up, buy it from the private owner and turn it into this popular, amazing park, Parque Niños Unidos. Once it finally got built in 2002, this is when you had these former industrial areas that were in the Mission were, you know, pieces of lands that were inherited, that were bought for a song and a dance at one time, whose families have been holding on to them for decades, that saw this boom happening, you know, this quote-unquote revitalization, and, you know, converted their former industrial lands to condominium housing. And we started seeing in all the marketing and the promotions, up-and-coming neighborhood, there's a park here. Let me tack on a few hundred thousands to my property now because of this hard-fought battle that was won by community. And yet they're not able to enjoy the benefits of a revitalized, resilient community. Right across the street, there was this magnificent Victorian house, run down, you know, but it was just beautiful, just the same, where you had five elderly women, you know, from Central America, had been living there for 30-plus years, who were all Ellis-acted, all displaced. These were women that were like 70 years and above, and similar to this caller, very self-sufficient, hard women that, you know, got this place, and the building is still empty. The owner hasn't done anything with it. Yeah.
Yeah, and I was thinking, as the caller was telling that story, and I've got these maps in front of me again. Your listeners can't see them, but they're dots. They're blue dots and red dots and green dots, depending on the type of eviction. And just in the three-year period, 98 to 2001, really the height of that boom, there must be 200 or 300 of these dots on this map just for the Mission District. And I was thinking, you know, the story this person's telling is a blue dot. And look at all these dots. I mean, this is the human experience at absolute ground level. And one of the things I love about the work that we do is we get a chance to meet a lot of the folks who are actually housed by the work that some of our organizations do. And when you have that one-on-one human experience, you realize how critical it is to have stability around your housing. And when somebody gets displaced, it is more than heartbreaking.
415-841-4134 to join our conversation tonight on City Visions here on 91.7 KLW San Francisco on affordable housing in San Francisco with our guests Peter Cohen and Oscar Grande. 415-841-4134. Email us at feedback@cityvisionsradio.com or post a comment on our Facebook page. Let's go to our next caller, John from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I've been a real estate developer in San Francisco for about 25 years, and I'm not a Republican. I'm not even a Democrat. My politics are much more progressive, but I just want to make a an observation, because I think there's a little bit of an informational deficit here, and that is that at the moment I'm doing a 7-unit project in the city, and the cost of that is approximately $480,000 in fees to the Affordable Housing Fund and additional fees to the city of almost the same amount. So to build 7 units, I'm paying almost $900,000 in fees.
And where are your units?
The location doesn't matter because the cost is the same anywhere.
I guess one question I would have is, what do you expect those units to go for once you sell them?
I don't know, because I can't read the future. And I think the issue here, which is really not being addressed, is one of income inequality. And I don't think it's possible to fully address that simply through imposing various restrictions on housing creation. I'm sympathetic to that, but there's an enormous burden right now. And the process of approval in this city is as inefficient, endless, and at times corrupt as it could be. And it's aggravated by these onerous costs. And I don't think it really serves anyone's purpose.
Could you say a little bit more about this income inequality issue you're concerned about?
Well, I mean, I don't think it's a secret that the city and the country has enormous gap between the rich and the poor. And it's reflected in some of the housing dislocations that are being discussed on your program.
And so you're saying that perhaps the income inequality issue is what really needs to be addressed here?
Correct.
And that the solutions to affordable housing are never going to really get at this core issue.
I'm not suggesting we give up entirely, but there's a limited amount you can do.
Okay. Thanks so much, John, for perspective. We appreciate it. 415-841-4134. Again, 415-841-4134 for your questions and comments. We'll go to our next caller in just a second, but I saw you nodding your head there quite a bit. Peter, what do you make of John's comments? First off, that the fees that he's paying to the city are pretty high, and that really this is what we're not talking about here is the income inequality, and if we're really going to deal with housing affordability, we really have to go there as well.
Right. Well, I'm not going to take on the fee level. I acknowledge that there are significant fees. There's no question about it. Whether they're too high, whether they're too low, or what they are relative to the value of development is something that can be discussed at length. But I'm intrigued by his comment about income inequality. And, you know, it's easy for us to come across as kind of a one-trick pony, where as long as you're building affordable housing, everything's cool. And it's very significant that we look at the economic development, the kind of jobs, employment side of things, and small business development. I think Oscar can talk a lot about that part of the story in the Mission District. But it's important, I think, to remember that some of the frontline neighborhoods in San Francisco that are going through the most intense transformation, and for the most part, it's the eastern and southeastern part of the city, were in many respects working-class neighborhoods historically. And they grew up in and around factories and factory districts. This was an industrial town for much of San Francisco's 20th century history, really took off during World War II, but all the way through the 60s and 70s. And so you had the Mission District, you had the Bayview, you have Central Waterfront, you had South of Market, even the Northern Waterfront, Chinatown. These are areas where they were basically, you know, working-class neighborhoods with jobs nearby, and many of those jobs were decent paying. You know, this was a working-class, middle-class kind of environment. And so what's happened as the job environment has transformed is many of those jobs aren't there anymore, and folks are left to very underpaid jobs and yet living in a city where the housing market is going the other direction. So it's sort of a double hit. And I completely disagree with this caller, which is why, again, I mean, our organizations work really intensely around economic development policy in addition to housing, because it's kind of a both-and approach.
Mm. Oscar.
And I would say, you know, the caller John reminded me of that this is a multi-sector approach. I think that he's absolutely right. We here in San Francisco, we see a huge income disparity. You got folks that are doing really bad, and you got folks that are just doing really great, you know, making more money. They know what to do with it. And we see this income disparity in places like the Mission District. We're seeing it in South of Market. We're seeing it in these southeastern neighborhoods where traditionally it's been communities of color, working class, blue collar communities. And I do think it is a multi-sector approach. I think, you know, we need to, on the economic development side, is really push and fight for demand better wages and benefits. We need to, invest in our manufacturing. And we need to not make it as this sort of niche or sort of this artisan industry, which is the city loves to do, you know, but really invest in an economic strategy that is putting these frontline communities to work first. And I think the city putting all their eggs in one basket, high tech or this fledgling clean tech, we really need to see where the skill set of our communities are. We just finished a process in District 11 with our supervisor, John Avalos, supportive, where we went out and talked to over 300 residents and five different languages about what are the skill sets that exist in the community. How do we invest in that skill set and invest in an industry that meets that skill set, from young workers to middle-aged displaced workers? And I think that's the approach that the city needs to take and stop doing these kind of top-down approaches where we put our eggs in one basket, mm-hmm. and then have housing policies that meet where our community members are at as well, and not just chase, you know, high-tech workers or chase people that have the most amount of money.
415-841-4134. We'll get a couple of calls next. Let's go to Lisa from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. Well, I don't know if this applies here, but it's about being a homeowner and the way that I thought affordable housing as a homeowner was to buy a TIC, because TICs in San Francisco cost less than homes or condos. So you start off with a much lower price of the house. However, although most of the people who buy TICs are doing what I did, because that's the only way to get in if you don't have a lot of money, the policy is that's applied to TICs is as though we're buying them to rent them out. So we end up paying commercial interest rates. So I may have gotten a low price on my house. However, I'm paying over 8% interest. So there's this, you know, flip of it where you get into the affordable housing, so to speak, and then you're screwed because of the interest.
So you're talking about from a home buyer's aspect that the getting into the market here is quite challenging as well because of the interest rates that are specific to this particular financing model, the TIC.
The TIC, right. And that's part of why TICs cost less, I believe.
Thanks so much for your call, Lisa. 415-841-4134. Let's go next to Karen from San Francisco.
I'm actually calling from Berkeley, but I lived in San Francisco for many years. I moved up from Los Angeles there in 1980. San Francisco, the jewel in the crown of cities, just exquisite architectural, historical town, beautiful. And over the years, and I was a homeowner there and a small business person and someone who walked all over the city with my family every single weekend and enjoyed the beautifulness of the city. And it seems what's happened over the last 30 years or so is that greed, which is this giant virus that's covering the globe, insinuated itself into San Francisco, and neighborhoods destroyed, cultures being destroyed, people being evicted. Everything has a big dollar sign on it, making it very difficult. The hotels took up all the empty lots to build 16 of the same hotel, and the city politically went along with the developers, because as long as I lived there from 1980, it was always, we've got to build affordable housing, got to build affordable housing, mayor after mayor after, you know, group downtown. And look at it. It's still the same. Look at Hunter's Point. It's still a mess. It's still polluted. And what's a shame is that I come into the city to visit friends, and there must be, there were 10,000 homeless people when I moved there, and I lived there in the 1980s. At least, now there's got to be 15,000 homeless people on every single street corner. So I don't know what's going on in the city with the mayors, with the developers, with, you know, property owners, whatever, but it seems to me that San Francisco really needs to be cleaned up, and they really need to provide low-income, not just affordable, but low-income housing. Give people a home to live, get them off of the street, give them some self-respect and ability to kind of get, you know, cleaned up and go out and get a job.
Thanks so much for your call. Let's go next to Maya from San Francisco. Maya?
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi there. I am just calling in regards to a comment I heard earlier where you said that you went out and assessed people's current skill set, and we were trying to build tomorrow based on what we have today. And my thought process was, if what we had today was working, we wouldn't have the giant need for change. So assessing where we are is a fantastic starting point. But moving towards where the future is going, and yes, we're talking high tech, yes, we're talking about Stealth Research and that whole UCSF Mission Bay, we need to be going towards where we're going, not where we're from. And I was hoping you could address that.
Okay, thanks so much, Maya, for your call. A quick response to that, because we have a few more minutes and I have a lot of other questions for you. Oscar.
I think that where we're starting where we're from, because those are the assets that are in our communities. That's a starting place. You're absolutely right. Then we need to match up policies with growing industries, but also liven up and invest in industries that aren't necessarily leaving the country. They're leaving to other counties. They're leaving to other cities. And I think that's where we're trying to come from, as well as supporting entrepreneurship opportunities within our own communities, small business development, etc. You're still going to need stuff cleaned. You're still going to need a haircut. You're still going to need a place to buy a taco, burrito. Well, why not people from your own community doing it? Give them the resources to make it happen.
So, Oscar, to go back to the affordable housing part on the movement side, what kind of solutions are you looking for moving forward?
I think for us, it's been really inspiring.
So what would create more affordable housing? What kind of things should we be trying?
Well, the strategy that Poder is taking is really looking at public lands and putting them into community hands. And so,
So
we don't have to go through the competition and fight developers for private lands that we can never afford. Is that the city
owns a lot of assets, has a lot of lands in their hands right now, from the school district to the Public Utilities Commission, the Mayor's Office of Housing. I mean, you could run down the list of agencies that have lands at their, you know, that underutilized, that they're maybe leasing out for parking lots. That those are opportunity sites. Those are sites that we can bank on today with the intent to develop in the next 5-10 years, the economy gets better, or new pockets of funds open up, that those are pieces of lands that we can develop for affordable housing, for low-income housing, and potentially, you know, address the need within, you know, that income range right above low-income, you know, teachers. We're looking at school district sites, 1950 Mission, potential collaboration and partnership with the school district. Our teachers are leaving the city because they can't afford it. My wife's a teacher, and with my salary, We can't get affordable housing, yet we'll never be able to buy something on the market. So there's opportunities here to address housing needs for low income, extremely low income, and even to the moderate income side. But I think what's important is that we need to differentiate the difference between moderate income and middle income housing, which the current debate's going on right now, where should we put subsidies? I don't think we should be subsidizing families who are making over $100,000. They have options in this housing market. Maybe you're not going to be able to buy your dream house, but you're going to be able to live in a nice neighborhood and maybe rent and work your way up to buying something. But where we see the need is those families making under $80,000 because they have no options.
Okay. And Peter, what kinds of solutions and strategies do you see? What do you take out of the conversations that Mayor Edley is having to build the Housing Trust Fund?
Sure. Well, you know, funding comes first. We got to have those resources to be able to do any of our work. And so that's the primary thing. But looking out ahead, I mean, I think there's a few different strategies that I would say we need to continue to explore. One of them that I keep thinking about is this notion of land banking. I mean, we need to look at those frontline neighborhoods where the change is happening rapidly, where that land speculation is happening really quick and prices are getting driven up. How can we set aside sufficient number of sites over the long term, like 17th and Folsom that Oscar was talking about, that are there in the queue, not just for tomorrow, but looking out into the future, so that as the neighborhood changes, we're able to keep up with that pace. The second idea is we need to start thinking small. We've done a really good job in affordable housing over the last many decades, but increasingly projects are going towards large because it's an economies of scale. The reality is in San Francisco, particularly, again, these kind of neighborhoods, you're talking about small lots. And so we need to get a parallel model that allows us to develop housing at smaller scales. It's affordable. And then thirdly is this notion of acquisition or rehab. Not everything is just a brand new construction. There's a lot of good stuff out there. There's beautiful historic buildings. There's fine buildings. There's no reason to tear them down. A lot of the SRO rehabs have been along those lines. So we need to really increase our skill sets around acquisition and rehab of existing housing stock and turn it into permanently affordable. Those are just a few kind of long-term strategies. And then on the moderate income housing, I mean, we've been very supportive of that. And it's one of the things that we've embraced because we don't want to be into an us versus them. I think the income range that Oscar's talking about is, again, the one we're promoting. It's since a kind of an 80 to 100% of area median income, you know, that $80,000 to $100,000, because those are families who really don't have choices. They fall below the market. They're above most subsidized housing. If we can figure out how to proactively increase that production, we're good with that.
And what do you predict is going to come out of the conversations that Edley is having?
Well, I think we're going to get ourselves a housing trust fund. That's really good. And then the hard part, I think, going forward is going to be back to the conversation about employment, is to link our housing policies with the direction we're going on job development. It's still kind of a mismatch. I mean, we're definitely actively chasing the tech industry, promoting it, creating land use policies, and we have housing policies. The question is, what kind of a match is for that? And are those local residents moving up through those job ladders as well as into the housing? I mean, that's the kind of ideal synergy between those policies.
Great. And we're going to have to stop it here. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Pierre Cohen, Council of Community Housing Organizations co-director, and Oscar Grande, community organizer with Poder. Thanks so much for joining me this evening.
Thank you.
For this and other City Visions shows, go to our website at klw.org and look up City Visions. And our producer this evening was Matt Fidler. Our engineer this evening was Debbie Kennedy. Our senior producer is Susie Britton. We'll be away next week for Memorial Day. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Actually, Lauren Meltzer will be here then. I'm Joseph Pache. Good night. Have a great week.